Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Today, we are going to have a program that looks at inflammation, cancer, brain diseases, and the microbiome, and we managed to tie it all together, so that should create some suspense, I think. We're going to start off with a story that appeared many years ago. Oh, before I do that, you can call me. I would love it if you would wait until, 5 minutes from now, but 831-900-5773 is our number, and also on air at ksqd.org, and that's on air without a hyphen. So we're going to talk about what seems to be a typical case of dementia praecox, what we call schizophrenia. And they called it dementia praecox in previous centuries because it was a dementia-like illness that occurred early. Well, this guy was 23 when his delusions came on, and he became convinced that his thoughts were leaking out of his head and that other people could hear him. He thought the actors on TV were signaling him. And, of course, he was irritable and anxious and couldn't sleep. In Japan, a psychiatrist, I will do my best, Dr. Tsuyoshi Miyaoka, a psychiatrist who was treating him at the Tsumen University, eventually diagnosed paranoid schizophrenia. He then tried a series of antipsychotic drugs, but none of them helped. He was labeled treatment-resistant and placed in, I presume, a secure setting. A year later, he got much, much worse. He developed fever, fatigue, shortness of breath, and it turned out he had acute myeloid leukemia. Myeloid leukemia is a type of blood cancer, a bone marrow cancer, and in order for him to survive, he would need a bone marrow transplant. Well, he got his bone marrow transplant, and after that, his delusions and paranoia disappeared. His schizophrenia simply vanished along with his cancer. Years later, he's completely off all medication and has no psychiatric symptoms. So the transplant of the bone marrow somehow cured the brain. So let's think that through. A bone marrow transplant basically reboots the immune system. First, you take bone marrow out of the person's body and you separate off the stem cells for the blood. Then you kill off the bone marrow with drugs, essentially overdosing of chemotherapy that we might ordinarily use to treat a cancer. It's possible that these chemo drugs somehow cured his schizophrenia, but that would be a one-off. The more likely thing is that his immune system was somehow driving his psychiatric symptoms. And there's a growing body of literature suggesting that the immune system is involved in many psychiatric disorders, from depression to bipolar disorder. I've shared with you previously on this program many articles about the microbiome and microbiome transplants and how that can cure depressive symptoms in both humans and animals, which is pretty strange. Going all the way back to the 19th century, pre-antibiotics, physicians in mental hospitals noticed that when infections tore through the psychiatric wards, the fevers seemed to cause an improvement in some of the mentally ill and even the catatonic patients. So in the early 1920s, an Austrian physician, Julius Wagner Jorag, developed a method of deliberately infecting psychiatric patients with malaria to induce a fever. Well, some of his patients died from malaria, but the majority of them recovered from their schizophrenia, and he won a Nobel Prize in 1927. There are other recent case reports in the medical literature about psychotic symptoms, in one case, schizoaffective disorder, sort of schizophrenia with light with depression, that were gone after a severe infection with fever. And doctors have noticed that, contrary to being cured. People who suffer from autoimmune diseases like lupus can develop something called lupus psychosis. It looks exactly like a psychiatric illness. And we believe it's a result of the immune system attacking the brain, or maybe a more generalized inflammation affecting the brain. We're not really sure. In the last 15 years, there's been a field emerging called autoimmune neurology. And there are now 24 autoimmune diseases of the brain that have been described. You may have heard about PANDAS. PANDAS is a childhood condition where children abruptly develop obsessive compulsive disorder, touching things, counting objects, and great anxiety, like overnight, in a day or two. Very strange, not the usual way this develops. And it's due to a streptococcal throat infection in the previous couple of months, and the immune system is essentially attacking a protein in the brain that is a part of the brain that is instrumental in keeping us from having OCD, the perseveration, and it is currently turning out to be actually a not that rare condition. And so neuroimmunology has an annual conference that I try to attend remotely that's always fascinating. There was also a book that I read, I highly recommend it actually, Susanna Callahan's memoir. She's a journalist, and she wrote a book called Brain on Fire. And she had anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. These disorders show up looking like bipolar disorder. They can also look like epilepsy or dementia. And that's often how they're misdiagnosed initially. But when promptly treated with immune suppression therapies like we would use for autoimmune disease, what looks like dementia or bipolar or even epilepsy reverses. So there's a doctor at Johns Hopkins, a professor of developmental neurovirology, a new field, Robert Yolkin, who estimates that about a third of schizophrenic patients show some evidence of immune disturbance. It'd be very interesting to know exactly how many of them have an autoimmune component of this. And there's an old puzzle, you know, like, let's talk about sickle cell disease for just a second. This is a digression, but it's not entirely so. Sickle cell disease is painful and causes early mortality. You would think that a recessive gene like that would be bred out of the population, but it's not, because if you have one copy of the sickle cell gene, you actually are resistant to malaria. And in Africa, where the majority of people who have sickle cell have ancestry, being resistant to malaria is a survival benefit. So what's the survival benefit for schizophrenia? Because people with schizophrenia tend not to have many children. So now it's not a simple heredity, but we do know that it is genetic. So maybe some of the genes that increase the risk of schizophrenia also help fight off pathogens, or maybe they just make the immune system more aggressive. Either way, there may be an immunity syndrome here. Now, the original patient we talked about, the person with acute myeloid leukemia, he had a paraneoplastic syndrome. That's a possibility when a cancer patient's immune system attacks a tumor. In this case, because the central nervous system had a protein that looked something like something the immune system decided to start attacking. Paraneoplastic syndromes are widely known in oncology, and they always, always fake you out because the person looks like they're psychotic, and yet they actually have cancer. Now, here's a proof of concept for you. We love these. This is a case from the Netherlands. And in this case, a man who had leukemia received a bone marrow transplant from a schizophrenic brother, and he beat his cancer, but he developed schizophrenia after being transplanted with that that bone marrow that of his brothers. So that's another way of thinking about, the immune system can definitely cause schizophrenia. Maybe there's not just one schizophrenia. Perhaps one of the paths is auto-inflammatory, another path is autoimmune. So giving people a fever or doing a bone marrow transplant isn't going to make it, but we need some other therapies that might reduce this brain inflammation. And about a decade ago, the same doctor, Dr. Miyaoka, discovered one. He treated two schizophrenic patients who were both institutionalized and practically catatonic with an antibiotic, one used for acne, minocycline, very old-fashioned drug, but both completely normalized on the antibiotic. And when the doctor stopped the drug, their psychosis returned. So he prescribed them a low dose on a continuing basis and discharged them, and they're doing well. And other trials have suggested that minocycline may be an effective add-on treatment for schizophrenia. It probably works because it's an anti-inflammatory, just like statins probably work because they're anti-inflammatory, but they have other purposes. But that's not the reason for this benefit. It's also possible that it has an effect on the microbiome and changes the immune system. So Dr. Jochen and colleagues recently explored this idea with probiotics. We have always talked about probiotics and the microbiome. They focused on patients with mania, which has a relatively clear immunological signal, apparently. During manic episodes, people get an elevated level of inflammatory cytokines. These are chemical messengers that are secreted by immune cells, white blood cells, macrophages, that control the response. You've heard of the cytokine storm. We all know about that from COVID a few years ago. And that's really what we're talking about. Those cytokines get into the brain. He had 33 mania patients who had previously been hospitalized, so he had them take a probiotic prophylactically. Over the next 24 weeks, the patients who took the probiotic, along with their meds, were 75% less likely to be readmitted to the hospital for manic attacks compared to patients who didn't. So this is a preliminary study, but it raises the issue. I want to point out in this particular study, probiotics in general reduce inflammation. So we really need to, let's say, broaden our horizons. And I remember a book that was very popular in the 70s by an author called named Thomas Szasz, never was sure how to pronounce that, called The Myth of Mental Illness. And there was a lot of thought in the in that era, the 70s and 80s, that maybe a lot of mental illness was a physiological phenomenon. And one of the things that they were doing was orthomolecular therapy in people with schizophrenia and psychosis. And that involved giving very high doses of B vitamins, which are, you guessed it, anti-inflammatory. We're beginning to use gene typing of the entire microbiome to identify specific bacteria involved in helping or harming your health. This is not infection. I need to emphasize this. We're not looking for an infection. We're looking for, it's not a pathogen. It's not going to give you diarrhea. It's an infestation, like a weed in a vacant lot. So for an update on gut gardening and the current status of, here we go. We know the immune system is vital for safeguarding the human body against infections. The trick is getting it right. There are numerous inflammatory diseases that are observed in people. Some of these, polymyalgia rheumatica, primarily in older people, spinal muscle muscular atrophy, vasculitis, sarcopenia, cirrhosis, cancer, and fibromyalgia. These are all inflammatory disorders. Also, many, many people have irritable bowel disease, also a disease of inflammation. And what we know in general principle is that your diet has a major impact on the microbiome, on the flora, and it shifts very rapidly. Within a week or two, you can see massive shifts when a person, let's say, goes on a ketogenic diet. The intake of Mediterranean-style foods promotes what we think is the best microbiological profile in the microbiome in terms of resistance to disease, in terms of calming an irritated gut, in terms of modulating the immune system, letting it flare up to fight disease, but stopping it from continuing to flare. Now, in contrast, we have the Western diet. So Mediterranean diet, what exactly is that? That's a diet that is high in fiber. It has fish, beans, lots, and most of the protein in that diet is probably coming from plant sources or fish. It does not have a lot of dairy in it. So contrast that with the Western diet. Western diet, high meat, high saturated fat, high simple carbohydrates, and at least in the United States, high processed food. So the gut microbiome really is the key factor in irritable bowel disease. And using fiber and prebiotic interventions, certain prebiotics are extremely helpful in promoting the growth of specific bacteria. So these are, you know, just a really non-drug way of treating what is a very distressing condition. And we have just amazing amounts of data that going on a Mediterranean-type diet, eating more fiber, using probiotics can make a big difference. Now we're going to pivot to away from inflammatory disease for a moment and reframe fibromyalgia, because fibromyalgia is a disease that's been very mysterious to everyone. It's a complex disease. It's characterized by chronic, widespread muscle pain. The researchers who are looking at fibromyalgia and the microbiome have been analyzing the microbiome and the serum composition. And they found that in people with fibromyalgia, there's a drastic diversity reduction. So you're essentially monocropping in the gut compared to having a biodynamic farm. The absence of bifidobacterium and eubacterium, particularly the eubacterium, is really important because we see that as part of the profile, the genetic profile of the bacteria in the gut of people with fibromyalgia. And these bacteria participate in breaking down neurotransmitters. And if these are reduced, these neurotransmitters get recirculated. And one of the neurotransmitters that appears to be a real bad actor in this dynamic is glutamate. Glutamate is a excitatory neurotransmitter. It's associated, among other things, with that book, The Brain on Fire. She had a inflammatory disorder that affected her glutamine receptors. Glutamine overstimulates certain areas in the brain, and specifically in people with fibromyalgia, we see increased activity in a part of the brain that is known to be associated with pain. And it correlates really nicely with these microbiome changes. So is it about neurotransmitters? Is it about the gut destruction or failure to destruct these neurotransmitters and their recycling up the vagus nerve into the brain? Well, very likely. So from here, I want to move our topic to chronic pain. This paper was published in February of last year, Gut Microbiota in Chronic Pain, Novel Insights into Mechanisms and Promising Therapeutic Strategies. So chronic pain affects 30% of the world's population. Let's define it: an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage. But actually, chronic pain can become a disease. Acute pain is responsible for notifying the body of danger, but in chronic pain, that function, that critical function of transmitting danger signals is lost, and instead what you have is pain noise. And that can be very devastating and very disabling. It's usually triggered by injury or some kind of disease, but it eventually morphs into spontaneous discharge and changes in nerve conduction in the spinal column and a type of nerve fiber injury that is not direct. It's indirect and inflammatory. So I mentioned that it's happening in the brain. This is a really interesting study looking at the gut microbiota and this pain. So they used brain biopsies, when you can't get any more scientific than that, of the anterior cingulate cortex, which is involved in pain processing. And in germ-free mice, they found with who had essentially no bacteria in their gut, they found that this area of the brain was substantially affected. They had marked changes in the dendrites. That's the interconnections between the neurons. And when they tested these germ-free mice with a scientific test for gut sensitivity, they found it. Now, what they do with that is they put a little balloon in the gut, and they're measuring the nerve impulses that are generated, and they blow it up slowly. And the threshold where you start to, so it's like if you're not having pain, it's tick, 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 tick. As they start to blow the thing up, the nerve sends a stronger, faster signal, tick, 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 tick. And when you get it to tick, 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 it's pain. So what they saw was that it would go to a faster rate of transmission earlier in these mice. Then they also looked in the spinal cord and the brain, and they found increased inflammation there. So they took essentially clones of these mice, other germ-free mice, and they colonized them with the fecal bacteria of normal mice, and that reversed these changes. And these are physical changes in the brain and in the spinal column, and not just local in the gut, where you could say, well, it's something being released locally. This suggests that we might be able to treat not just irritable bowel syndrome with fecal microbiota transplantation, which is, you know, debatably successful in a lot of the cases, but also treat fibromyalgia. And we know that the that breakdown products that the bacteria make of the food we eat affect neuroinflammation. They affect the immune system, the neuroimmune system, I should say. And the metabolites of healthy bacteria, like short-chain fatty acids and bile acids, actually reduce inflammation. So I won't go into the specifics, the real weeds here on what these bacteria do. But what I'm finding exciting is that we've got specific bacteria here that do specific things, and we understand the mechanism, and it is very likely that we will begin to orchestrate our pain control, not of just of digestive disorders, but also of things like fibromyalgia. What about chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy? Big side effect of use with platinum. I have a friend right now who's getting that and is suffering from the peripheral neuropathy, and I'm trying to help him with acupuncture techniques that I use for peripheral neuropathy. And I can't really say whether it's working or not because we haven't done enough cases, but I'll keep you posted on that. I'm doing my own little, you know, one-off science project just to see, can I move this? But there's this significant association with this and microbiotic changes. So the question really is, if we fix the microbiota or we find those metabolic properties, then figure out a way to essentially manufacture them, could we make a better pain control treatment that wouldn't have the that would probably have all sorts of downstream effects to help people with their risk of cancer and all sorts of other things. So one more story before the break. This one's about postpartum depression, because the immune system offers clues there. We've talked about how inflammation can modulate depression. And about 700,000 Americans a year experience depression during or after pregnancy. Suicide accounts for 20% of deaths in the immediate postpartum period. We've got to work on that. And last year we announced, I'm sure you heard it, the first drug that's specifically designed to treat the condition. It's ZURZUVAE, and it's a neuroactive steroid. It basically looks like a breakdown product of progesterone, a hormone that is excreted through the bile down into the microbiome where it is processed. So this drug works extremely quickly. Unlike antidepressants, it seems to be really fixing what's broken. There's, of course, lots of challenges in getting that drug to everyone who needs it. But just let's talk about pregnancy for a moment in this frame. Think about it for a moment. We reject organs that are transplanted into our bodies from a random individual, but we don't reject a fetus, which is 50% not us. So there's some enormous immune changes taking place during pregnancy that allow it to tolerate a visitor. And then suddenly, when that visitor leaves, there's just a massive gear shift. It's like going from fourth gear into reverse in a manual transmission, and it pivots the body. It's really hard on it. So the inflammation changes through pregnancy. In the first trimester, there's increased inflammation that actually assists implantation of the embryo. In the second trimester, the immune system shifts to an anti-inflammatory state. And in the third trimester, the immune system rapidly ramps up and goes into pro-inflammatory to promote uterine contractions, prostaglandins, right, and the birth of the child. But then you have to turn that off. And it's the inflammatory cytokines that can get into the brain and trigger neuroinflammation and trigger depression. And this is probably what pregnancy-related depression is, primarily. It's an inflammatory subtype. And there's direct evidence that the more inflammatory cytokines in the blood, the more severe and suicidal the postpartum depression is. And there's just a dysregulation, a failure of coordination. And of course, it doesn't help that you get very sleep deprived when you have a baby. Researchers are also seeing in rat models that serotonin is involved here. And this is a breakdown product of, there's a breakdown product of tryptophan. Okay. Tryptophan's an amino acid. It's supposed to, in the gut, get made into serotonin. That's supposed to help go to your brain and keep you calm. What we see in stressed animals is that the stress causes their microbiome, instead of making serotonin, it makes a compound called kynurenine. And you can measure that, by the way, in the urine. It's one of the things that shows up when I do organic acid testing, when I'm scratching my head and someone with fatigue and I want to see if there's something wrong with their mitochondria. I will do this kind of testing. We do see the increased kynurenine in certain types of dysbiosis. So which is the chicken and which is the egg? Which is creating what? But that's really not the question. It's not about breaking it apart. It's like figuring out, where is the handle that I can pull to shift this? Can I give more serotonin to women? Yeah, I can give serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and they kind of work, but they take 2 months to really get rolling. That's not good enough when you're talking about someone with a suicidal depression. Before we go to our email section of the show, I just want to kind of calm everyone down. There's been a lot of stuff popping up in the news media about, oh my God, bird flu. And so I hope that you bothered to read more than the headline. But basically, there's an outbreak of H1N1 bird flu in dairy cows in Texas and Kansas. And one person who works with cows has been diagnosed with bird flu. That would be a mammal-to-mammal cross-species infection. Of interest, this is only the second time that a person in the U.S. has been diagnosed with this particular type A H5N1 virus. Back in 2022, a prison inmate work program picked it up while working on a poultry farm in Colorado. Both men have been only mildly affected. And so there's no evidence of person-to-person contact. There's no reason to believe that the meat or milk from livestock would be dangerous. And best of all, our current antiviral medications seem to be working for this particular strain. So the people who are vigilant are being vigilant, and they're telling us not to worry. And the people who are doing clickbait are telling you to worry. And I'm just saying, ignore the clickbait. I've seen a lot of it the last few days, so I just wanted to put that out. So we'll move now to email, and we had some interesting ones this week. Just a shout out to David in Kansas City and Nick in Los Gatos. They both sent me the same article wanting to know what I thought about this study. The title of the study is Kombucha Can Mimic the Effects of Fasting in the Body, According to a Study. And so I'll first of all give you my caveats. The study was in worms, and there is a particular worm that we use, something elegans, that is just it's got big chromosomes, and so it's easy to test, and it's become like the lab rat of the insect world. So in the study, they looked at markers for fasting, and they wanted to see whether if they gave kombucha, because it's supposed to be healthy, and it's associated with changes in how fat is metabolized in the gut, and the changes that we see in terms of physiology, which is to say increases in lipoprotein lipase, which breaks down fat, and decreases in the rate of making fat, sort of what you'd expect from fasting. But if you can get it to happen from kombucha, well, then that suggests that it's the microbiome and certain of the bacteria that are part of this, you know, it's basically a bacterial mat. Primitive life, right? All the way back to before you have multicellular life, you have these sort of mats of bacteria which form. It's like the first multicellular organism, although it's a colony organism. So anyway, that's what kombucha is. You mix starter and bacteria and yeast and tea and sugar, and you sit back, and it starts to process the sugar, and eventually you get all of the metabolic products of that processing. And when they tested C. elegans by essentially putting it in a kombucha, they found these changes occurred in the way that the worm was metabolizing fat. They saw increased expression of the genes responsible for the fatty acid metabolic changes that I described. And this is seen, as I've said, in the bodies of people undergoing fasting. So it's very preliminary. And the idea that you might be able to bypass the fasting and just drink the kombucha is probably not true. I wish. On the other hand, I want to really emphasize, maybe it is true, but if you are going to try to do this, you need to basically use real kombucha, the kind that you grow, the kind that grows in your teapot when you forget that you left the tea and sugar in the teapot, and sometimes you get a bacterial mat. Here you're going to want to get the spore, or the SCOBY, it's called, which is just essentially looks like goo, and grow your kombucha from that. You are not going to imagine that if you go and buy one of the 6,000 commercial kombuchas out there, that you're going to get anything like the benefit that you saw in the study. Kombucha itself, when it is made traditionally, is not a sweet flavored beverage resembling soda. It is a little bit on the bitter side, and you can, of course, water it down to reduce the bitterness and drink the real stuff, and you might get some of the benefits of fasting, a reduction in your lipid stores, a decrease in your triglycerides. I don't think that you will be able to substitute diet and exercise with kombucha, however. So that's my opinion there. And I did review the actual paper and look at what it said. It's interesting from a biological standpoint, but to think that this is going to be therapy is really premature. That being said, I'm going to start making kombucha, and I'm going to check my lipids and see what happens to my triglycerides, because I eat a pretty consistent diet. And it would be interesting to see if it drops without me changing my calories. But I'm going to do it with the real stuff, like I said. So I'll probably be watering it down quite substantially in order to get it down. If it's very, very tasty and it's made in a factory, it's probably not good for you. Okay. Let's go to our next email. This from Peggy in Long Island, New York. Peggy tells an amazing story. Dear Dr. Don, I've loved your show for years, and the information you take the time to share and explain is much appreciated public service. A little backstory. I had led a very sluggish, unhealthy life until almost 2 years ago when I was diagnosed with colon cancer. Fortunately, it was a T2N0M0. So I'll explain that means that the tumor was 2 centimeters in size, under an inch, that there were no positive nodes and no distant metastasis. So it hadn't left the room, so to speak. Surgery was curative. I emerged from the scare determined to change everything. In the last 20 months, I've worked very hard, thoughtfully building my fitness routine to what it is today. Zumba, 4 times a week, kickboxing, 3 times a week, gym, 3 times a week, boot camp, 1 time a week, yoga, 1 time a week, hula hoop fitness, 1 time a week. Basically, I work out every 12 hours, and I average 90 to 100,000 steps a week. My diet is low carb, high fiber, limited sugar. I eat a big healthy breakfast around 10 a.m., no lunch, finish dinner by 6, with no eating after 6, only coffee. I've lost over 75 pounds and have built quite a bit of muscle. At 58, I'm the strongest I've ever been, and I feel great. The thing is, I still need to lose another 30 pounds, but have stalled completely in the last few months. Do you have any suggestions to jumpstart my progress so I can keep moving in the right direction? I know there's never an easy fix, but I'm entirely committed to putting in the work. Thank you so much. I just love listening to your podcast when I'm at the gym. Well, I guess she has plenty of time to listen to the podcast. I just want to say, Peggy, wow. Just wow. You have chosen life and transformed your life at a level that is just truly astonishing. So some advice. First of all, don't worry too much about a number. Take a look at your BIA. That's your muscle to fat ratio. It's basically measured electrically, but you can have it done. Many spas will do it. I recommend having it done not with a scale that you stand on, but with a machine where you have little electrodes attached to your foot and our hand on the same side. I think that's gives you a more accurate look at what's going on. Have your doctor look order an hemoglobin A1C and a fasting glucose and a fasting insulin. Because from the standpoint of your not get cancer again goals, those are the things that are really going to tell us about your success. You don't mention family history, and I'm just going to assume a neutral average family history there. I'd love you to try my little kombucha experiment. Like I said, I'm going to start making it and play around with seeing if what it does to my lipids. But again, not the commercial stuff. If you're going to use flavorings, you can use like natural fruit essences or something like that, or mint. Probably I'm going to try mint because I think that'll be biologically neutral. But in terms of, okay, how would I weaponize this? I'd work on it. What you're doing is great. You may, after all of those years of not behaving so with the halo floating over your head, not have the world's greatest microbiome. So notwithstanding your big healthy breakfast, you don't really tell me what that is. I would say increasing your fiber and maybe doing a little probiotic therapy. There's a particular probiotic called Akkermansia mucinophilia. I've talked about it before on the program because it's one of the ones that we know helps modulate the immune system. And it also raises GLP-1. GLP-1, of course, very much in the news in the last few months because of the Ozempic and Mounjaro and all of those wonderful tirzepatide, all of these things that help you lose weight magically. They're all essentially mimics of GLP-1. Increasing your GLP-1 doesn't just affect your appetite. It looks like you've got that under control, but also affects the way your body processes calories. And so that would be a nice, healthy way of trying to move the needle a little further south on the weight. Again, hope it's helpful. If you do try the thing with the kombucha, let me know if you find it helpful in breaking out of your plateau, let's call it. Let's call it a plateau on your journey. We have a call coming in, so I'm going to go ahead and grab that. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Dr. Dawn.
Can I have your name and where you're calling from, please?
Yes, Ray from Santa Cruz.
Hello, Ray.
Hi. About kombucha, I have a question. I am a regular consumer of kombucha, and I do try to get the best, the organic, and, try to find the one that has the less sugar, because I was told that I needed to have an intake of less sugar in my diet. Now, a friend told me that because the kombucha is made in a sugar solution, that I'm getting too much sugar. You said you're making your own. Is there a difference when
Yes.
you make your own as far as how much sugar you're consuming?
Well, yes, there is. And the difference is the duration of the fermentation. So if you let kombucha sit there forever, it will eventually kill itself. It'll get so acidic that the bacteria and the yeast will die. Now, and it also tastes vile at that point, so no one's going to drink that.
It's all in the fermentation.
Yes, but the terminal fermentation is, but we don't let it get that far, right? So the question with sugar is, if you wait long enough, they will metabolize much of that sugar. So it's not such, it's kind of one of those details of when you start it out, it's sugar, but then it gets magically transformed through the alchemy of the bacterial metabolism into lactate. And the lactate itself is, oddly enough, I have an article about that I was going to talk about. Lactate is actually an anti-cancer agent. Lactic acid is produced by cancer, but the basic form, you have acids and you have bases, and the base molecule of lactate is actually discourages cancer growth. So intriguing that this compound has a bunch of lactate in it, because in a solution, the lactic acid and the lactate are going to bounce back and forth. So if the molecule is lactate, however, when it hits the receptor, it's probably an anti-cancer agent as well. So this is the reason that I did that story was the idea that it might mimic fasting is very intriguing, because of course, when we fast, we go into ketosis. And so the question is, could you be signaling the body to process fat differently with all of these compounds that the microbiome of the kombucha is making? My concern is palatability for the consumer. When a commercial company is making something, whether it's all organic or not, they have to pass the taste test. And so you'll usually have blind taste tests and which one do you like better? And that sort of drives the market. So there's an evolutionary pressure, if you want to think of it that way, to make the best tasting kombucha, which is probably also the least effective kombucha. And certainly in the case of this study, they were not using commercial off-the-shelf stuff. They were making a version of this in their laboratory. That's in the method section.
Right, are you saying that the mushroom metabolizes the sugar in the fermentation process?
Yes, the bacteria in the mushrooms eat the sugar and change it into something else. And then it might have completely different properties, and it will, you know, lactate can potentially be metabolized by you as fuel. And, you know, that's an interesting thing. But for the most part, in doing that, you're going to induce a whole bunch of different set of enzymes. So this is code. This is like a computer code that you're running in your tea and your sugar, and it's producing this output. And then you're drinking the output, and it is acting like computer code in you to shift the biological properties, at least in the worm. Whether it works in humans, we don't know. We know fasting works in humans, and we know that these things resemble each other. It's worth a try. I think there's lots of benefits to kombucha just from the healthy microbiome standpoint. So I encourage the use of all fermented foods. All traditional fermented foods are probably really good for you. And well, maybe not vodka, but that's been distilled.
Okay. One more question.
Sure.
When I read a label of different kombuchas, they can run from, say, less than 10% sugar to like 24%.
Right. So go with the lower sugar, because they had to ferment it longer. So it's going to have others. The sugar that they started out with has been transformed.
Okay. Go with the lower sugar.
I would say go with the lower sugar, because when they put the ingredients in there, I think it's what you start out with, not what you end up with on the label. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think so. I think when it says higher sugars, what's happened is they've taken the fermentation to where they've taken it, and they've either added more sugar for palatability, or they haven't fermented it as long for palatability.
Oh, I got it. Okay, well, that's very informative. Thank you so much. You've cleared up doubts in my mind. Thank you.
Yeah, I am very happy to do so. It's been an interesting discussion. Thanks so much for calling. Where are we? We are coming up to the end of the hour, and I do have time for this email. It's pretty interesting. This lady, Inez in Spain, sent us an email last week about chilblains and pneumothorax, and I was postulating that perhaps she had a collagen vascular disease. This was a person who had had multiple episodes of pneumothorax and was suffering from chilblains, which is basically where the blood vessels in the fingers shut down long enough that little bits of skin lose their oxygen and nutrition long enough to become extremely inflamed. And it's, you know, typical in cold climates. This lady's in Spain, and she's getting it when it's not cold. So I postulated there might be something else going on. Well, it turns out there was. I'm going to read her follow-up letter. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I am Inez, the woman from Spain with pneumothorax and chilblain. Thank you for your early reply. Thanks, too, for your medical opinion and pieces of advice. I have never been examined for autoimmune disease. I will take it in mind for my next medical check. But I'm not as flexible as you mentioned, so I suppose not a collagen disorder as an explanation for the frequent pneumothorax. The only lung biopsy I was done was inconclusive, but all the radiological tests, x-rays, and CT scans suggested lymphangioleiomyomatosis, but my lungs are full of blebs and cysts. But apart from multiple episodes of pneumothorax, I'm asymptomatic. Thank you again for your advice and recommendations. I will follow you for sure. You're an unconditional radio listener, Inez. So first of all, thank you, Inez, because that is a rare disease that I have never heard of. And it is, in fact, I am pronouncing this one correctly, lymphangioleiomyomatosis. And it is a disease usually inherited or caused by a new mutation that occurs in adulthood, primarily in women. There seems to be some connection with hormones. It's exacerbated by high estrogen levels, which is why it's so much more common in women. And there are various mutations in a couple of genes that I won't get too deep in the weed, but this one is a rare disease. 3 to 7 cases per million women in one study, 1 in 400,000 adult women. And it commonly hits at about the age of 35. It is the development of multiple benign tumors in multiple organs. And it can hit not just the lungs, but the kidney. That's the second most common organ, the liver, the brain, the heart, the skin, and the eyes. So for Inez, the first thing I wanted to say is, get your kidneys checked to see if you have polycystic kidneys related to this. That would be confirmatory. It sounds like the lung biopsies, which we don't like to do more than once if we don't have to, were inconclusive. They can, of course, find new gene probes. One of the interesting things about this disease, besides the fact that it affects so many organs, is the fact that it can be acquired. Now, people with this do have skin lesions, but basically they're white spots on the skin and grooves in the fingernails, nothing dermatological that comes even close to your chilblains. So we're still not entirely sure that this is what you've got. I think it's the closest fit, but I'm not convinced that we can say for sure. There is a drug that is used for this. This drug affects mTOR. mTOR is a gene cassette that's extremely important in cancers. There are some drugs that are thought to inhibit mTOR that might actually be life-prolonging, but when it's messed up, it usually is associated with cancer. Really, really interesting thing about this disease that we're talking about is even after a complete lung transplant, the disease can recur in the lungs. So is it really in the lungs? I think that's a very good question. And it's a medical mystery. I certainly don't have a solution for that. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.